Is marriage an archaic institution? Some contend that it gets in the way of personal happiness and fulfillment. In fact, marriage has been on the decline in the United States in recent decades. But are we actually happier and more fulfilled? Hi, I'm Richard Nelson with The Commonwealth Matters. Joining us to talk further about marriage and why it's good for us is Dr. Brad Wilcox, professor of sociology at the University of Virginia and director of the National Marriage Project. He also serves as a fellow for the Institute for Family Studies and the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Wilcox is the author of numerous books and articles defending the importance of marriage and the family. His most recent book is the topic of our conversation today. It's called Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. Brad, welcome to The Commonwealth Matters.
Good to be here with you, Richard.
So let's start out with your title. That's provocative, and it implies that the elites somehow are undermining marriage or sending the wrong message about marriage. And I'm guessing that has something to do with the decline in marriage rates in recent years. Tell us what you mean by how we must defy the elites. Where'd you get that idea from?
Yeah, well, what I've seen, Richard, is that too often our elites kind of tend to discount or deny the importance of marriage in their kind of public capacities, even as they kind of often embrace marriage privately, kind of in the privacy of their own homes and neighborhoods. And so just kind of one example of this is when my book title was first kind of coming out onto the internet last summer, I got some pushback from a center-left journalist named Matt Iglesias saying, well, the elites are doing fine when it comes to marriage. What do you mean defy the elites? And the irony was that Matt Iglesias had a number of years ago as a journalist written an article headline, something like, the decline of marriage is not a problem. So here you had a guy who had kind of publicly in his role as a journalist kind of minimized the importance of marriage, even though he himself, I think, is stably and happily married, you know, father, by all accounts, you know, things are going well in his own, you know, private family. So it's just kind of an example of how our elites in their roles as journalists, professors, you know, school superintendents, C-suite executives often will either do nothing for marriage and the family, or they'll kind of publicly say it's not important. Meanwhile, when you look at their own private lives, they're doing often something that's very different. So what I'm trying to argue in the book is that we should defy elite messages that are kind of not family friendly. And of course, the most recent example is the kind of promotion of polyamory. And kind of encourage our elites to basically preach in public what they practice often in private.
Our listeners, Brad, know that one of the core pillars of society that the Commonwealth Policy Center works for is strengthening marriage. When we first began in 2012, marriage was still defined for the purposes of state and federal law. Marriage was defined as being between one man and one woman. That all changed in 2015 when the U.S. Supreme Court essentially redefined marriage. I noticed, by the way, that, of course, you know, that we're in a very different culture now today because of the redefinition of marriage. But I noticed that I was looking at some of the reviews of your book, and you were criticized for not looking at same-sex marriage. And I don't want to go into that too much, but in that context of the redefinition of marriage, how do we carry on the conversation, or has it impacted your book and what you pursued in this book?
Yeah, it hasn't been a big issue for my book. And as I kind of mentioned both in the book and as we've done some research on this topic for the Institute for Family Studies, what we find is that kind of despite the dramatic kind of cultural clash that we had, you know, about a decade ago around same-sex marriage, I think maybe in some ways the surprising thing is that less than 1% of parents are same-sex, you know, legally married couples. And so it's not been like a huge issue in terms of on the ground for kids and families. And so also as a scholar, kind of focusing on where married families are most likely to, in a sense, be at, I focus in my book on heterosexual married couples, in part because they're the easiest ones to study in a national survey like the ones that I've, you know, conducted for the book. So they're just, when you look at kind of ordinary couples, families with kids across the country, what you see again is that more than 99% of them, I'm trying to think that, well, I look at the denominator there, but the vast majority of married parents with kids are heterosexual. And so that's why I focus, you know, on them in the book.
Very good. Brad, you say in your book that our civilization is in the midst of a huge shift, a shift away from marriage and all the fruits that follow from this most fundamental social institution. children, kin, financial stability, and innumerable opportunities to love and to be loved by another. Too many young men and women are closing their hearts to marriage and family life, or are unable to find a partner with whom to forge a family in the first place. So first of all, let's start with this. Why this shift in thinking? In the last couple of decades, there's been a major shift away from the idea that marriage is a good thing, that it benefits people, that it is good for family formation and for society. Can we point to a particular time or a particular influence that has shifted our thinking?
Well, the great writer Tom Wolfe had a phrase that he used to describe the 1970s. He said it was the me decade. And I kind of think signals for us how in the late 60s and the 1970s, there was a big shift from kind of what I would call family first thinking to kind of more me first thinking, where once you would prioritize your obligations to your spouse, towards your kids, towards your parents. And really in the late 60s and especially 1970s, it was kind of more like, what makes me feel happy? What do I desire? Not what are my kind of obligations, you know, to family and kin and whatnot. And so that was, I think, a major part of this sort of shift towards what's called expressive individualism in the 1970s. It's kind of been with us since then. And then beyond that, we could see, you know, obviously more secular society kicking in that moment. It's been with us since then. I think also kind of shifts in the economy that made it harder for a lot of younger guys who weren't college educated to be flourishing, you know, and to be attractive as providers. And then I would also finally say just a lot of the public policies that came in the 1960s and 70s ended up penalizing marriage for first poor couples and then working class couples in ways that often make it more financially, in a sense, prudent for them to cohabit nowadays rather than to put a ring on it. And so a lot of factors, but they've all kind of conspired to kind of weaken marriage in our culture and our country since the late 1960s, but especially among poor and working class couples. And that's something that people don't always recognize in how this has all played out.
Brad, you're a sociologist. Your book is full of research and numbers. You reference studies, but you show in your book statistically that marriage is good for people as far as their emotional health, psychological well-being, physical health, relational, and financial, other categories as well. And just after reviewing that and thinking, there's a lot of good reasons to get married. And I'm thinking, just for pragmatic reasons like those, you'd be better off married than unmarried. And yet there is a strong message from the elites, messages from Hollywood and influencers in our society that say, no, it's a drag. You start out in your book referencing Andrew Tate, the social media influencer who is dead set against it and very critical of it. I guess I'll ask this. How do you overcome voices like Andrew Tate? I don't think a lot of young people are going to read this for the statistics or say, yeah, statistically, this is good for me. I should get married because of all these different reasons. I think people are more influenced by a personality or a strong voice. So how do you, I guess my question is, how do you overcome a strong voice like that when it comes to reaching young people?
Yeah, great question. So it is important just to underline that from the left, we've been hearing a pretty negative message about marriage and motherhood for women. The New York Times had a piece that said married motherhood in America is a game no one wins. You know, again, targeting women with a kind of anti-marriage, anti-family message, and talking about the kind of the emotional cost of being a wife and mother. And then now, obviously, Andrew Tate on the online right or the red pill right has been saying that, you know, there is zero statistical advantage when it comes to marriage for men. And so the kind of red pill right is basically telling men, you know, to steer clear of marriage and family. What I think we can do that is both kind of your center and then also, you know, me at the University of Virginia Institute of Family Studies is to kind of, you know, tell the truth, which is that for the average woman and the average man, much better off financially on average if they get and stay married. And also they're about twice as likely to be very happy with their lives compared to their single and childless peers. So the facts don't fit what this sort of left wing and now red pill right narrative is kind of telling us. But then probably, you know, I'm not going to be an online influencer like Andrew Tate. Probably you're not going to be either, Richard. But I think if we're kind of, you know, sharing this message, you know, in our own capacities, but also maybe working to have like the success sequence, you know, passed and implemented in the state of Kentucky, we can basically convey to a lot of young adults, to school children across the state of Kentucky, for instance, that the science tells us that, you know, young adults who get married are much less likely to be poor and much more likely to be happy. So I think there are ways that we can kind of pull levers in the policy world, like where you sort of sit, and in the journalistic world, in part where I often sit, that can kind of send a different message that will then be taken up by other people, including hopefully more family-friendly influencers, you know, to kind of push back on the Andrew Tate or that New York Times, writer's message about motherhood and marriage.
Brad, you say in your book that the modern dream of success is measured merely in dollar signs in free time. It does nothing to measure things like meaning. I thought that was profound. In our post-Christian, very secular culture, we look at things like college degree. What kind of job do we have? How much are we making? But those things really don't offer us meaning in life. And that's the case that you make. Tell us how marriage, or why marriage and family, contribute to meaning, and that that's a better measure of happiness.
Yeah. So Richard, I was asking my wife, actually, appropriately enough, for kind of like a myth that would kind of, or a legend that would kind of convey an important truth about marriage. And she said wisely, you know, what about the Midas myth, or in the Midas legend? And of course, it's the story about a king who was kind of looking to gold as sort of his source and summit of his life. And then because he's, you know, kind of turning everything to gold, unwillingly turns his daughter into gold. And he's, you know, at that point, beside himself, right? And so it just kind of tells us that if you make the Midas mindset your lodestar in life, you're going to end up in trouble. And I think our culture is doing that more and more in terms of education, having a lot of free and fun time, and especially in kind of thinking that the most important thing about our lives is our work, you know, is our career, rather than sort of seeing family and friendship as, you know, two key touchstones for us. And so in particular, I can show in my book that people who get married are markedly happier than their peers who don't get married, and that nothing predicts happiness in life like a good marriage does. Not a great job, not frequent sex, you know, not good health, you know, you name it in the data that I look at. You know, if you have a good marriage, that's going to be the most powerful predictor of a happy life. So I'm just trying to get people to sort of shift their thinking away from that Midas mindset and towards a more family first or marriage mindset when it comes to how they run their lives.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you're just joining us, you are tuned in to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, here with Dr. Brad Wilcox. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, and he is the author of the book called Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. Brad, you focus on four groups in your book that are largely benefiting from marriage. You call them the strivers, faithful, Asian Americans, and conservatives. And the first question is why are these groups entering marriage at a higher rate, and why are they more successful?
So there's kind of a, you know, a cultural story here and a financial story here. It's about culture and class, basically. And just to start with the financial piece, what I find with most of these groups is that they often have guys, you know, within their ranks who are stably employed full time. And we still find in the 21st century that women generally are looking for guys who have a decent job, and they're more likely to stay married to guys who are gainfully employed. And so I think we can't minimize the importance of, you know, money in general, but also more particularly, you know, men taking their financial responsibilities, their professional path seriously. Now, again, I'm not saying that they should kind of go all in like we were talking about just a second ago, but just to, unfortunately now there are too many young men who kind of don't take high school and or college and or some kind of vocational, you know, training seriously. And they're not making a real effort in their 20s to, you know, to kind of be employed full time and to get, you know, their career launched successfully. And so I'm looking for basically a basic minimum of seriousness for guys who are interested in getting married and being good husbands, you know, to their family. So that's one piece, that those four groups tend to have guys who are, you know, have got their professional act together. But then culturally, a lot of these groups, you know, religious Americans and conservative Americans especially would tend to prioritize marriage more than other Americans would today. And a lot of the virtues that go with marriage, like fidelity, for instance. I mean, one of the most striking things we're seeing today, Richard, I just wrote about this week for Family Studies, got a lot of attention, is we're now seeing a 30 percentage point gap between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to their embrace of the classic fidelity norm that, you know, you shouldn't have sex with someone besides your spouse. And that's in part because the left has embraced polyamory in the last decade as one of their pet causes, you know. So people who don't fall for those kinds of, you know, fashions and kind of embrace, you know, some more old school commitments when it comes to marriage, including fidelity, are more likely, not surprisingly, to be flourishing in marriages today as well. So this, again, a cultural story and the financial story that help to explain why those four groups are more likely to be getting married and either happily married or stably married today.
So I want to go to the faithful, the group of the faithful. Religion has been criticized as a negative towards marriage. You mentioned this in your book. Some say that it's a negative force, but you're saying, in fact, I'll quote, "No, the truth is that religion is generally a force for good when it comes to the quality and stability of married life, men's and women's satisfaction with their lives, and the welfare of children. The research tells us that American men and women who regularly attend a church, synagogue, temple, or mosque are significantly happier in their marriages, less likely to end up in divorce, and more satisfied with their lives, and their children are more likely to be flourishing." And you back this up with the numbers. You're not just pulling this out of the air, but this is statistically true, that those who have a religious basis, a religious foundation, as they enter marriage, they're going to have happier lives and more stable marriages. And this contradicts what the political left, if you will, is pushing, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I mentioned that there was an interview in the New Yorker between Isaac Chotiner and Professor Sam Perry, who's a progressive sociologist, and it kind of just, you know, painted a portrait of Christian evangelical men and their wives as kind of stuck in archaic, you know, ideas about pornography and sex and the sacredness of marriage, and that they were kind of, you know, Christian guys were guilty about using pornography and their wives were divorcing them in high numbers and everything else. Now, there certainly is an issue with pornography that Christian couples, you know, I think are particularly likely to be concerned about. But what this particular article left you with the impression was is that kind of faith was an obstacle, Richard, to good marriages. And what it completely passed over in kind of in a very clever way, because Professor Perry is a smart guy, is that on average, Christian couples are about 15 percentage points more likely to be very happy in their marriages. They're between 30 and 45% less likely to get divorced. They actually now have more sex than secular couples, and they're more sexually satisfied than secular couples. So all of these like big, important, positive, you know, points were completely ignored in this interview with The New Yorker. And so again, the public is getting this message that religion is an obstacle to good marriages, and yet the data tell us a very different story. And so my book on, you know, kind of unpacks why it is that, you know, on average, and I'm not saying, you know, that religion is some kind of like magic pill you take and everything's perfect, because, you know, I'm a practicing Catholic and, you know, my wife and I have had our challenges over the last 28 years of marriage, but it does tend to strengthen and stabilize marriage and family life in ways that typically benefit religious couples.
Brad, those points that you mentioned, those are pretty important points that were missed in the New Yorker article, very, very conveniently missed. Brad, I want to press into this a little bit more. Marriage is an idea from God. We read in the book of Genesis that God made them male and female, brought them together. In fact, in Genesis 2:18, he said, it's not good for man to be alone. Of course, marriage is good for both male and female, but this is a religious idea. It's a divine institution, if you will. It's not something that government came up with. And there's something in our DNA that tells us about what marriage is and our need. I mean, most of us are created to be in a marriage, or at least we have that impulse. It's in our DNA again. And yet there's strong pushback from various forces in our society, the elites that we talked about earlier. We also mentioned that the U.S. Supreme Court has redefined it. We're seeing it redefined in other countries as well. Do we have any statistics that show that the redefinition of marriage, and this is what I want to go into, whether it's same-sex marriage or polyamory, are there any numbers that indicate that they're really not as happy or not as stable as the heterosexual covenantal man-woman marriage?
So we haven't really seen kind of, I think, definitive evidence on that score, Richard, you know, in terms of the same-sex question that you're raising. I think the polyamory question's also kind of a very new issue. So as a social scientist, can't really kind of give you any definitive evidence on that. I think on the polyamory side, what I would say is that we do know that kids are more likely to be at risk when they're exposed to unrelated adults kind of coming through the household. And so one of my concerns about polyamory is the way in which it would kind of often, I think, introduce unrelated, especially adult males, who are more likely to be, we know from the research that I talk about in the book, to be unfortunately implicated in things like, you know, the sexual and emotional and physical abuse of kids. So I think that's the concern for polyamory. And then the other point I think that's worth mentioning in connection with your question is I'm a Catholic, but as a social scientist, what I think is striking is that we have, you know, research from Joseph Heinrich at Harvard, who's an evolutionary anthropologist, and he talks about marriage as kind of the primeval institution we find in most civilizations. So even kind of beyond a religious perspective, I think it's worth noting that, you know, you find marriage obviously in the West, you find marriage in China, you find marriage in Egypt, you find marriage in Nigeria. So it's just kind of important to note that I think the vast majority of civilizations kind of have found their way to this core institution because it tends to strengthen and stabilize family life. It tends to give direction to the sexual relationship between men and women, and then also tends to kind of push men in a more pro-social direction. So these are all some of the reasons why that, you know, we should be concerned about marriage's fortunes here in the United States.
Very good. I want to go to a portion of your subtitle about saving civilization. So Brad, you say in your book, marriage plays a central role in organizing family life, promoting human flourishing, and maintaining social order. Marriage binds children to their fathers, stabilizes romantic relationships of adults in the family and the lives of children, and bridges the gender divide between men and women. Do you have can you point to anything, any research that says that when marriage doesn't form, society suffers overall? We know that individually, we see people not as fulfilled, if you will, as if they compared to those who are married. But do we see statistics or research that shows that society suffers overall when we have failure of marriage formation?
Yeah, Richard, great question. So I'm actually sitting here, you know, about 2 miles to the east of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. And what, you know, we see in his obviously famous phrase about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is that that's kind of a core American idea that's embodied in the Declaration. And today we're seeing more difficulty when it comes to life. There's deaths of despair have been increasing in recent years. When it comes to sort of the liberty idea, I think a lot of Americans are experiencing difficulty realizing the American dream and report that in polling. And then we're also seeing when it comes to the pursuit of happiness, a number of different surveys, Gallup, for instance, the General Social Survey, for instance, have seen marked declines in happiness being reported by Americans across the country. And we've got research on all three of those outcomes, kind of tying those trends nationally back to marriage trends. And so just for instance, to kind of give you a sense of this, recent study from the University of Chicago telling us that kind of the strongest predictor of the decline in happiness using the general social survey was the fact that fewer Americans were married. Similar findings, deaths of despair, and then also when it comes to the American dream, we know that two-parent families in the community are strongly linked to poor kids' odds of making it financially in America. So there's a lot of research that kind of shows us that what happens in our own homes, Richard, doesn't matter just for ourselves, for our mates, and for our kids, but for our neighborhoods and for our broader communities as well.
Very good. Brad, we have just a couple minutes here. I want to close with recommendations that you might have for policymakers. We talked about, you'd mentioned early in the program, that in the 1960s, policies changed to undermine and even discourage marriage. So what can local and state and even federal policymakers do to encourage marriage?
Sure. So at the federal level, I think we've got to eliminate marriage penalties that make programs like Medicaid, for instance, penalize working class now married couples with young kids. I've talked to a lot of people here in Virginia where they don't have access to private health insurance, mom's on Medicaid, they're cohabiting, not getting married in part because of this Medicaid penalty. So there may be flexibility in the way in which Kentucky does things to address this, or to use TANF money to kind of give working class married parents some kind of break. And that could be something you could explore with your legislature, for instance. At the state level, I think getting the success sequence into public schools across Kentucky would be great. This is this idea that getting at least a high school degree, working full-time in your 20s, and getting married before having kids reduces your risk of poverty just 3% in your late 20s and your 30s. And I think a number of states are going to be considering measures in the coming year, in 2025, to get the success sequence kind of inserted into either some kind of financial literacy across their states or into relationship education across their states.
Very good. Brad, we might need to have you come and speak in front of our Kentucky State Legislature to talk about some of the things that can be done to shore up marriage here in the Commonwealth. Hey, man, it's been great to have you on the program. Appreciate your good work. Again, Brad Wilcox's book, Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. Great read. Strongly recommend it. Brad, thank you again for joining us.
Appreciate it, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you all for tuning into the Commonwealth Matters. And if you could, go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us, and then tell your friends about us. Until next time, may God bless you.